Good morning. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'll be here for Joy Cardine for the rest of this week. Our guest this hour is John Peavyhouse, an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the co-author of the forthcoming book, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. And this hour, we're going to be talking about the war 4 years on. What are your thoughts 4 years after the invasion began? Does it really matter anymore at this point whether the beginning of the war was justified? And does it matter now how the U.S. gets out? What does matter in this discussion? We'd like to hear your opinions, and you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or if you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. You can also join us by email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. John Peavyhouse, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, good to have you along, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks a lot.
Now, I understand that we almost had your co-author with us.
Almost. The weather in Washington held that up a little bit over the weekend, but I'll try to do it myself.
I think you'll be just fine. Well, let's start, because we were talking a little bit before the program began this morning, and I asked you, you know, when you started writing the book, and you said, well, fall of 02, mm-hmm. and doing some quick math in my head, that was well before the invasion of Iraq.
That's right. What spawned the book was I've had a long-running interest in American foreign policy, and we had, if you'll recall, in October of 2002 is when the Senate and the House considered the authorization measures mm-hmm. for the war in Iraq, and there's just a tremendous amount of debate going on in the fall about is the war justified? Should we let the UN do more work? But there was also a large amount of the debate about, well, does Congress have the right to do this? Does Congress need to approve this? And of course, a lot of people saying yes. Under the Constitution and the War Powers Act, Congress should be debating this move. And others saying no, that in this time of, you know, the war on terror, post 9/11, the president has the right to do this. And the strange thing is my co-author and I, we'd heard all these arguments before, even though this seemed like a very unique situation. This is a long-running debate in American foreign policy, mm-hmm. sort of the individual roles of the presidents in Congress in shaping American foreign policy. And so we started writing the book on the premise that the debate over Iraq wasn't and isn't that much different than previous debates. And it's been sort of interesting because one of the main findings of the book is that, not surprisingly, it's about partisanship. That when you have unified government, when you have Republicans in control of Congress and the president, things tend to sail through. Presidents are much more likely to deploy troops in all instances as a way to leverage foreign policy. Same thing with Democrats. Democrats control both. You get a high rate of frequency of military power being used. Divided government, it's different. So then, you know, we get the 06 midterms, and lo and behold, now we've got all kinds of debates about, you know, individual bills and movements to pull the troops out. So I guess we just sort of got lucky on the timing in a way about, you know, all of this has sort of played out like we thought it would, but it's not so much that I think we, you know, really had a genuine and unique idea, rather that we just took some lessons from history and saw how this had all played out before.
Now, as we are in the fourth anniversary this week of the invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. You said you were interested to see how your theory sort of played out. I mean, mm-hmm. were there any surprises for you along the way?
Well, the book focuses really on sort of the lead up to the war. And we talk a little bit about, you know, once the war starts happening. And one of the surprises, I think, was if you look at past wars, given sort of the rates of casualty, the circumstances around this war, you had another set of elections before you had the 04 presidential elections mm-hmm. and the midterms. And, you know, even though at that point, you know, there was still a debate over how the war was going. I think a lot of people foresaw bigger shifts even in that point in 04, that there's been a little bit of surprise on our part and others that it, you know, it took 4 years. It has taken 4 years for the polls and for a lot of people studying the war to sort of say, well, you know, it's not going well, it hasn't been managed well, et cetera. And again, that's you know, a lot of people would disagree with that still, that they think there is still hope and there is still a possibility. So we don't write the war off. You can't write that off at this point. But nonetheless, sort of the length of time it took to see public opinion shift on the war, even though very early on it appeared not to be going as planned, was a bit of a surprise.
Were there some unique circumstances, do you think, that led to that? You know, I'm thinking of, you know, 9/11. I'm thinking of supporting the troops. I'm thinking all those sort of factors combining into one thing that led to that delay and in an opinion change.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think 9/11 had a lot to do with it. We had, you know, at the time, for two and a half years, Afghanistan was sort of off everyone's radar. It seemed to be going well. No one, the Taliban seemed to be down and out. And so everyone thought, well, you know, the previous, the administration had done just fine there. There's no reason to doubt them on Iraq. And a little bit of the, even if we have doubts about the war, we don't want to say anything that might discourage the troops. So I think you're right. I think you hit it right. You hit the nail on the head. It was some unique historical context that led to that.
Now, I don't like to play the what if card too much, but every so often it would be interesting to speculate what, like, if things had not changed in fall of 06 in those elections, because you talk about it's partisanship that drives a lot of this. If there had not been that change, would we be having the level of discourse that we're having right now, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think there would still be a lot of opposition. You'd still see, you know, the news was talking about the protests, the marches. We've seen those since day one when we thought about going in Iraq. But it's the power to sort of set the agenda that's so crucially important in Washington. A crucial part of our book and our study was looking at how local news, how print media, and how national news coverage echoed or did not echo the national debates on going into Iraq, or even echoed sort of what was being said on the Senate and the House floor. And we were, you know, really amazed to find that despite protests, despite, you know, all of the non-congressional and presidential activity surrounding Iraq, those two groups of opinion, we call them opinion leaders, really dictate where the media goes. I mean, if the president's talking about it, the media talks about it. And if Congress is talking about it, then the media talks about it. And that's sort of what we get. And it was shocking that in this debate over authorization in October of 2002, we saw huge spikes in local news broadcasts, national news broadcasts, print media stories about Iraq. The day after the authorization, the coverage of Iraq just evaporates. And, you know, there are still protests going on that's still unsettled. We're still in front of the UN trying to convince the Security Council. But a lot of that disappears. And so that was one of our big findings of the book, was that one thing Congress really does is it's exceedingly powerful at setting the agenda, both formally in Washington, but also with the media. So if the 06 goes differently, you're not seeing the oversight hearings as much. You'd see some, but you're not seeing as much of that agenda being set.
And, you know, you can sort of extrapolate from what you just said that if the president's setting the agenda on one hand and the Congress is setting it elsewhere, the folks who are protesting, the other voices in this conversation are not being properly covered by the media.
That's right.
Is that what you're saying, essentially?
Exactly. That's right. So if you've got if Congress and the president are on the same page, or if the president's saying one thing and Congress is sort of staying quiet about it because they largely agree, then there's sort of no outlet, there's no hook to really hang those opposition voices on. And on one hand, you know, you could say, well, that's too bad that you can't, that these protests don't get more coverage or that opposition doesn't get more coverage. And we don't make a normative argument on that one way or other. We're just saying, look, factually, look at what the media is covering. They like to cover the president. They like to cover Congress. And if those folks are on the same page, there isn't much of a story. For them.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine this week. We are talking about the war in Iraq 4 years in, and our guest this hour is John Peavyhouse. He is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison and the author of the forthcoming book, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. We're talking about that book, and we are also talking about 4 years in Iraq. We'll be taking your phone calls in a moment, 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. John Peavyhouse, one question I have about the media, because after the war began, you know, certain influential media, I'm thinking the New York Times and a couple of others, offered sort of a mea culpa that they didn't do their part in being, you know, truly skeptical, and that they did just sort of take things that were being force-fed to them. Let's move on from that one point in time where they apologized for and kind of go into 2003 and 2004 and 2005 and so on. Does your study indicate that there's been a substantial change in the way the media is behaving in terms of what they've been covering since then?
from the we've concentrated most of our data collection on sort of 2002-2003. There did not appear to be a large change at that point. We're now, of course, after the book is done, starting to look for ways to look back at, say, 05-06. So if we could sort of take two snapshots in time, you know, fall of 2002 right before the election, and then fall of 2006 right before the election. And we've got some of the raw data on that, but we haven't, frankly, been able to analyze it at this point. But from the initial looks, it looks like there has been a bit change in coverage. I mean, you get, as voices in Congress are becoming more skeptical, you're getting increasingly skeptical coverage from the media. And, you know, obviously there are people out there who think, well, look, you know, the media is very liberal. It's, they've been against this war from the start. And you find, so to answer your question, you do find some trends that the coverage is changing, even though, you know, the perception is, oh, it's always been against. That's actually not necessarily been true, that it's, again, as you've gotten more opposition in Congress, especially from the Democrats, you're getting more of a volume. As, you know, you may get in 04, 05, you might get one story a day or, you know, something like that. But now you're getting multiple stories a day. And importantly, you're getting local news and national television news covering this. And it turns out that, you know, there's a survey from the Pew Foundation a couple of years ago that showed that 60% of Americans get turn to get most of their news to local, you know, evening news broadcasts. And they also turn to other places as well, you know, internet, radio, et cetera, but that the single largest number on that is local television news. And so that's why we focused on that, because what's going on there tends to really shape opinions in the United States.
We're going to be continuing our discussion in just a moment. We're talking about the war in Iraq 4 years in, and we'll be taking your calls. 800-642-1234. If you're calling for Madison, it is 263-1890. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 23 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. Coming up after 5, At Issue with Ben Marins. For many women, there comes a time when they find themselves alone. Society often tells them how sad a time this can be, but after 5, Ben's guest talks about the power of being by yourself. That's up after 5 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are talking about Iraq 4 years into the war with our guest, John Peavyhouse, an associate professor of political science at the UW-Madison. Also the author of the book soon to be published, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. We'll be taking your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. John Peavyhouse, before the break, we were talking about the role of the media in shaping this particular war, and I wanted to kind of follow up on that thought with the role of media in previous conflicts. You can think big ones like Vietnam, or smaller ones like Panama or Grenada. Has there, do you know whether there's been a significant change in the way the media has acted from those previous wars to the one we're involved in right now?
I can't, our book doesn't deal with that, but just from my own research and anecdotal evidence, I could sort of say that it really varies by conflict, and that I think the general take is that prior to Vietnam, in most conflicts, we had what was called the Cold War consensus, right? That sort of everyone was on the same page regarding containment and the Cold War, and that the media was not nearly as critical. We find evidence that Congress was critical during that period, but not much evidence that the media was critical or trumpeting many critical voices. Then you get sort of the post-Vietnam and especially the post-Cold War world. And there we find, I would say, more similarities than differences, maybe not in terms of the volume and the certainly with the internet and the sort of what you'd call the globalization of the media, I guess, sort of the massive coverage that you got in Iraq. But think about two previous post-Cold War conflicts. I mean, Bosnia, which got a tremendous amount of coverage. And in fact, many people say one of the turning points in American foreign policy vis-a-vis Bosnia was when the American media was in Sarajevo in the fall of 1994, when Peter Jennings was there during that horrific Sarajevo market bombing. And that sort of brought the war home to many Americans. And you saw some public opinion shifts vis-a-vis Bosnia. Somalia is another one. Somalia is one of my favorite examples, because this is where the media is sort of paying attention to it out of the corner of their eye, but But then once it's clear that we're going to do something, in fact, if you remember, as the Marines were coming on, as the U.S. military personnel were coming on the beaches near Mogadishu, CNN had beat them there, and CNN was sort of filming them sort of invading. Mm-hmm. So it was literally the living room war that you were watching in front of you. And, you know, Somalia obviously ended up taking a turn for the worse in Mogadishu. And
part of that could be attributed to the media, too, with those scenes that we all saw.
Exactly. That's right. And so they were, you know, the media was part of that war in Somalia in a way that I think they had not been before, where they were in some ways allowed almost completely unmediated access to what was going on in that conflict. Because Somalia was on the state of near anarchy, there was no way to control the information sort of getting in or out. And so the media played a very large role, I think, not so much prior to Somalia, but certainly during the war, of shaping public opinion about that conflict.
Well, let's bring some listeners into the discussion here. We go to Milwaukee first, and David joins us. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Great. I love it when you set in and replacement.
Well, it's nice of you to say so.
I think you have a very balanced way of presenting the show, so I appreciate that. My question to your guest is it's regarding the media coverages of war as well, and I think after 9/11, there was sort of this almost unstoppable momentum of information that was coming in, and you know, I thought the media did a good job of reporting things. I thought there was a little overkill, but I thought they did a good job. But after the war started, after the United States went into Iraq, I started seeing sort of the media being caught up in its own snowball, and it was sort of a snowball going downhill that it looked as if they had no way of stopping it. In other words, stopping and saying, you know what, we really need to look at what's being said now. Not necessarily what's happening, but what's being said, because I think what was being said was driving what the media was doing, but the media wasn't checking it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we look at all of the things that have been said now, and it's like, wow, how did so many good reporters miss, you know, really getting at the nuts and bolts and the details? How did they miss all of the deception? And so I just want to get your guests' comments on that, because I think after the war, I think, you know, overall, all the media dropped the ball on that, because it was almost as if they were afraid to challenge the administration, the Pentagon. I mean, whatever the Pentagon threw out the back door, it just seemed like the media was there like lapdogs and just took it up, reported it. And, you know, it got to the point where I didn't know the difference between CNN and Fair and Balanced anymore, or Fox News, because everyone was reporting the same thing and no one was really challenging it. So,
all right, David, you wrapped a lot into that question, so we'll let our guest take a shot at it.
Sure. No, it's a very fair question, and I have a particular take on this, but before I get that, The 9/11 momentum, I mean, it's certainly there, and it's hard mm-hmm. to know what to attribute that to. I mean, some would say, well, there was this sort of, everyone was sort of wrapped up in sort of nerves after 9/11, and we were wrapped up in the momentum also of Afghanistan, right, which had just happened and initially went quite well from all signs. And so it's, you know, it's important to say that there was, as David pointed out, there was a context here. And, you know, one example of that we highlight in the book was, part of the case for war, and of course, you know, not that I want to get into the whole WMD thing at all, but, you know, there was a report that came out of the Department of Energy very early on in the Iraq WMD debate that suggested that all of these cylindrical tubes that Colin Powell was hauling before the UN were dual use. They weren't, in fact, going to be used for nuclear weapons. And there were a number of very noted experts saying, look, this is not, there may be other evidence out there, but this is not good evidence. The New York Times didn't report that at all. It made page 13 in the Washington Post. Meanwhile, page 1 and 2 were, oh, well, here's all this evidence that we're taking in front of the UN. So there was, I mean, there was momentum there. So the real question, though, is that why, you know, why was that momentum? Why didn't that get stopped? And so one potential answer is, well, you know, the media just didn't have access to better information, that the administration was being fairly secretive with the intelligence, et cetera. And that's, you know, that very well could be part of it. Part of the explanation that we have in the book, in, you know, sounding like a, you know, beating my drum here, is Congress. I mean, there were no critical voices inside Washington, period. You know, and there's the media, you know, look, CNN, they have reporters a lot of places, but at the end of the day, read any story from the AP, from CNN, from anyone, and it will be, quote, official sources say, right? I mean, you have to depend on official sources for your inside information. And if there's no oversight hearings, if there's no Congress sort of calling people to the mat on this, where is this information going to come from? And as a reporter, you could sort of stick your neck out and say, look, I don't think this is right. But if you turn out to be wrong, then that's your career on the line. Whereas if you've got a congressperson standing back there saying, hey, I don't think this is right, you could go interview that person and introduce critical debate on facts coming out of the administration and hang your hat on, you know, the opposition, right? And so from a, you know, I don't want to make, you know, reporters sound like they're opportunistic at all, but at the end of the day, there's limited resources that that reporters have and limited information that they can gather.
And there are also, I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly, there are limited resources. You talked about the New York Times not running something, and that's significant because papers like the Times or the Post or other large organizations drive news coverage.
That's right.
And so if somebody doesn't carry the story, that means somebody else may not follow up on it as a result of that. And all of a sudden, you do kind of have that snowball that David referred to, where one source or a couple of sources really drive a lot of the coverage that you see and hear.
That's right. And that's one thing that we found was that especially that's true in the print. It's largely true. It's more true in the print than it is in television. Mm-hmm. But it's still true in television, just not to the same extent. You see local, whatever comes on national sort of filters down to the local as well.
Let's go take a few more calls right now. Looks like Will is with us, and he is in Windsor. Hi, Will.
Yeah, thanks, James. It's a good program. As a non-commissioned officer in combat in Vietnam, as I looked at this invasion unfolding or the run up to the war, I think we went in blindly with no strategy. I think what happened is that they took the new Project for America report to control that region, and they had enough momentum after 9/11 where they could send people in and do the job. When we were moving so fast to get to Iraq, to Baghdad, I made a statement at that time that this will come back to haunt them because the people will not fight on their terms. It was guerrilla warfare. I see the same thing happening now when they say we send more troops into Baghdad to secure the areas. It's the same thing that happened in Vietnam. We would take a territory, leave it, and later on we will be back in time and time again. So it's no strategy here. And as far as the media is concerned, the media, I feel, is totally different from Vietnam. We saw the coffins come back from Vietnam. We got the report of the battles. And this is a sanitized war that was gone into on means of deceptions and lies, and I think the majority of the American people don't understand what war really is. They only see these blips on the screen that we allow to see. So the support is not there for it, and I think we'll be there for a number of years unless the people come out in force to stop this, because it's no win in it. When they had a chance where they could have turned Iraq around, they didn't do it. Instead of hiring the local people, putting them to work, employing them, what did they do? Bring in contractors from all over the world.
Okay,
so
well,
they
don't
have the hearts and minds of the people.
All right, thanks for your call. Well,
thank
we're going to put their questions to John P.B. House and a lot of things there. And let's start out where Will started out. And he started out with the premise that there wasn't really a strategy after the invasion.
Okay, so two points here. I mean, one is that I think this is so just thinking about the war itself and not so much sort of Congress here.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is something where, you know, the administration has really paid a price, and clearly Donald Rumsfeld has paid a price in terms of the strategy. I think, you know, if I were commenting on this as someone who studies sort of the Middle East and conflict generally, it would be that I think that's where a lot, you know, WMD issues aside, I mean, sort of the strategy here clearly was not optimal, to say the least. And I think there was a lot of sort of assumptions about what would happen with the local population, with the Shia in particular, that just did not happen. And that certainly got us into trouble with the insurgency. But let me take that point and reflect back a little bit. You know, one thing we found in Bosnia, so take Bosnia, where you've got a Democratic president, a Republican Congress, And you had a number of Republicans at that time, McCain, Trent Lott, and others, who were sort of saying, both over Bosnia and Kosovo, well, I think this war's okay. I'm going to get behind it, but we really don't have any strategy. And there was just sort of a lot of opening questioning in the media. If you read the Times or watch national news, this was the main debate over Bosnia in 93, 94 was, well, what's the strategy? What are the X's and O's look like on the ground? And, you know, as Will points out, we didn't have that debate at all. No one was standing up in Congress or anywhere else sort of saying, well, what's the strategy look like? It was, well, you know, we're going into this and maybe it's a good idea, maybe it's not. But no one was thinking about the strategy. And that's different than past wars, where the issue of strategy itself is actually something that gets tossed around a lot in politics. Something else Will talked about in terms of the timing, and this was something David said as well about sort of the rush into the war.
Yeah.
We actually look at this historically and say, you know, does the constellation of interest in Congress and does the media influence, responding to international crises? And without going into all the details about how we, you know, compute this, you know, it's actually anywhere between a month and a half to 2 months of delay we find where a president sort of waits to deploy troops if he's under a situation of divided government. So in other words, if you're a president and you're sitting with the opposition in control of Congress, you tend to take a lot longer to respond. And part of that is they're putting up roadblocks. There's a lot more critical voices in the media. So, you know, presidents like to have their ducks in a row before they go in. So the fact that we rushed in, maybe that was unique to Iraq and some of these circumstances that both David and Will pointed out. But we actually find historically it tends to be the general case that if you've got, again, Republican or Democratic presidents, same party power in Congress, you go into war much more quickly without a lot of this debate about strategy and other issues.
Another one of the things that Will brought up was the word Vietnam. And I remember in the fall of 2002 and early in 2003 when the invasion was taking place, that a lot of people were trying to make the comparison to Vietnam. They were trying to I remember the word quagmire came up way, way back then. And at that time, they're saying, no. We're two different situations. You can't make that comparison. There's no comparison here. That was then. This is now. That sort of thing. Now here, 4 years later, it's almost impossible not to make that, you know, that comparison to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, first, were there any lessons that anybody picked up from that particular conflict? Mm-hmm. And is it a fair comparison to make now?
That's a great question. I was one of those people saying it's not a fair comparison, you know, in 2002. Mm-hmm. I didn't think there were enough, close similarities there. Yes, we were talking about a conflict on the scale of Vietnam, potentially, and that made it similar. But in terms of the context, the background, the fighting conditions, at least at that point, it seemed like they were going to be somewhat different. And so now, you know, is the analogy better? Well, in terms of sort of fighting an insurgency that's melded into the population, and we're having difficulty setting up a domestic local government to deal with that. We're having mm-hmm. trouble training local troops to do that. A few months ago when President Bush started talking about the surge and started saying, well, the surge is basically going to be used not just for security, but to train, right? You know, you got these echoes of Vietnamization, right? The Nixon strategy of let's turn this over to the Vietnamese.
Right.
I think there are some surface similarities there. One thing, just sort of to bring Will's comment and your question together, I mean, one lesson that was learned by the Pentagon was about the media. I mean, that's why we have a sanitized war. You don't see the coffins coming back, is the military did learn their lesson and that they do need to control what comes out of these conflicts, which is why in the green zone, you know, American reporters, A, aren't safe, and B, just aren't allowed, you know, free rein to go around. This is why most of the sort of the controversial stories coming out of the region are coming from Al Jazeera, or they're coming from non-American media sources who can sort of sneak their reporters mm-hmm. in and out, not under the watch of the American military.
Who don't have to be embedded.
That's right, who don't have to be embedded. And that was the great, strategic on the part of the Pentagon anyway, that was sort of the great strategic advance of embeddedness, right? Was it, on one hand, everyone was saying, oh, it gets us this great look. And that's true, but it also gets them complete control over what the information that they have access to.
And really a very different way of covering the war. I mean, if you look at other wars, the reporters were embedded in the sense that they were with the troops often.
Right.
But they were independent and mm-hmm. they went where they went and they did what they did. And it was not under the auspices or control, really, of the Pentagon or the Defense Department.
That's right. That's right. So, the control that the Pentagon has on the information, rightly or wrongly, coming out of there has really, Will uses the word sanitized, and I think there's something to be said for, there's something to be said to that, yeah.
It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to get back to some calls from listeners on this. We're talking about the 4th anniversary of the war in Iraq with John Peavyhouse, an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also the co-author of the forthcoming book, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. And we'll be taking your calls after this break. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 19 minutes before 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this morning. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guests discuss how the Iraq War is affecting the campaigns of the presidential candidates. That's coming up after 9. This hour, we are continuing our discussion of the 4th anniversary of the war in Iraq with John Peavyhouse, an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison, and the author of the book, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. We're going to go directly to calls right now. We've got some people who'd like to join in the discussion, and Suzanne joins us, and she is in Wisconsin Rapids. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning. My question is what would the criteria be that we have victory here? Because I haven't seen a real victory in any of the wars that we have fought recently, except for the Second World War, where we went into Japan and we use an atomic weapon on them. And that, I don't think that people would be happy with that. But what would the sign of a real victory be?
Suzanne, thanks for the question, and we'll put it to our guest. Is that the whole issue of victory? Well, I'll just let you answer it. I was going to get more complicated, but I guess I don't have to.
Well, that's a tough one. Part of it, obviously, when this war started, I think the bar was fairly high. You know, people were talking about, you know, obviously finding these weapons of mass destruction, creating a stable democracy in Iraq that would be a beacon for other states in the region. And, you know, no one's really talking about that anymore. I think the most we can hope for is some semblance of stability, some semblance that we can leave Iraq and that you won't have the sectarian violence raging, that you'll have a government that's been elected democratically, that at least can hold down, you know, they can hold down the fort, essentially. I mean, I actually even think that it's likely we'll give up some of our hopes to create what would be sort of a Western-style democratic system. I think we'll win elections, but in terms of, you know, everyday freedoms and so forth, you know, I think if it means trading off to get security and stability, I think the Iraqi administration and I think the American administration will both potentially sign off on that. But I think it's sort of some semblance of stability, I think, is victory at this point. Now, the real thing that gets difficult is what kind of stability, influence of Iran in the region, which I see as a huge issue right now, and I think one that's really captured a lot of the attention of people thinking about the Middle East.
And while it may not be easy to define victory, I think failure might be easier in some regards because you think about Somalia with the soldiers being dragged through the streets. You think about Vietnam with the helicopters leaving Saigon. Mm-hmm. And those are the images that people remember from those conflicts.
That's right. And, you know, this is where this congressional debate over the troop pullout is becoming so pitched and so emotional, is about, you know, if we set a deadline, if we set a time, is that going to create an insurgent strategy that will just lead to scenes like that where, you know, the last Americans are leaving and Baghdad is up in flames? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is that I think that at this point, you know, the name of the game is stability, and not even stability as in there aren't any car bombs or there aren't any killings, but just is there a minimal number such that the Iraqi security forces can then take care of them and enforce some type of rule of law. I mean, I think that's what the strategy is at this point, is turn it over, try to get some stability that's enforced not by American boots on the ground, but rather Iraqi security forces.
Let's bring Scott into the gap and into the conversation, and he joins us from Appleton. Hi, Scott.
All right, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
For the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the media. My question and comment is, the New York Times holding off on the Risen story about the illegal NSA wiretapping until after the election, the 2004 election. Mr. Keller of the New York Times has come out and said that he waited until the election was done because it may have had an impact on the election. He had discussions with the White House, and also holding off on the Judith Miller Valerie Plame information until after the election. I have to look at this as the New York Times enabling the White House, and there could have been a change of administration, which to me, somebody was trying to prevent that change from happening, and I'll just listen to your comments on that.
All right. Scott, thanks for the call.
Sure. I mean, I think there's been a lot of anger at the Times on the wiretapping in the Judith Miller issue. You know, how much of that was orchestrated? How much of that was people like Judith Miller attempting to protect their sources inside the White House on a personal level, not so much protect them from being defeated electorally? But again, you know, these reporters rely on inside information. They rely on quote unquote leaks, sometimes which are accidental, sometimes which aren't, as the, you know, as the Libby trial made apparent. And, you know, I'm not willing to sign. Well, first of all, it's very possible, and I do agree with Scott. I think the New York Times did hold back on some of this. I guess where I might disagree a little bit is how much this really affected the election. I think, to me, the election was more about sort of the broader context. There were enough people that were still uncertain about the war, how it was going to go, not wanting to change course. and, you know, like it or not, I think there were a lot of independents in particular. Some of the polling is now showing that just they didn't find Kerry to be an attractive candidate. Is this an issue? Was this an issue? I agree with Scott on that. Did it influence the substance of the elections? Not clear to me that it did, that this just wouldn't have also been sort of been rolled up in some of the other controversies that came out right before the election and just sort of and dealt with in other ways.
Let's continue with the conversation right now and bring in Lance, who is in Antioch.
I guess I'm on the totally opposite side of all your callers and you guys. I see something totally different and have for years. The media has been totally on one side against Bush from the very beginning. The whole thing of being rushing into a conflict, 14-month wait with 18 resolutions by the United Nations that they were just ignored. I don't think that's rushing in. Then there was a museum artifact story where they said, oh, we didn't protect the museum artifacts. That turned out to be not true. It wasn't a whole bunch of artifacts stolen. The media spent a month crying about that. Then there's Abu Ghraib. I mean, we're still talking about that, and that was a couple of rogue people, Lindy England, with their sexual fantasies taking it out on some of these prisoners. Yeah, it was wrong, but it wasn't like torture, like when we think of real torture that goes on in countries all around the world where they pull your fingernails out and stuff. And then there's Gitmo. Remember they said that we were flushing Korans down the toilet? Turned out to be not true also. And, you know, the Democrats voted twice for the war. John Kerry himself said when he was running for re-election as senator, if there are no weapons of mass destruction, do not vote for me. And we just, you know, you just don't follow those stories at all, what the Democrats do. Mr. Sandy Berger breaking in, you know, stealing documents from the National Archives, that was a one-day story. He made a mistake. He is sloppy, is what everybody said, you know, 1 hour after it happened. Turned out that he wasn't sloppy. Turned out that he lied to the Senate.
So, Lance, you feel that the media has played a role in, and it sounds like, actively opposing the war. And is that their proper role, to be skeptics, or where do you see them fitting into the equation here?
Clearly they are one side. They are rooting for one side. They're rooting for George Bush to fail. Whatever he does, they are going to oppose. I mean, the whole thing with Joe Wilson was found to be a liar by the Senate Intelligence Committee. But that story, that doesn't go on. He's always projected as a hero in front of the media. They never really cover that story. They never cover the Sandy Berger story. The media is clearly one-sided. I can give example after example after example after example. It can go on and on and on.
All right, let's find out what our guest thinks about it, John Peavyhouse.
Okay, well, you know, certainly some of the individual stories that Lance brings up are true. I mean, I think there are all the time stories that come out that sort of get legs that there may not be much behind, and I think that, frankly, happens on both sides. In terms of the media, in terms of the rush into the war, let's take that one first. I think there was certainly somewhat of a delay. I guess my argument would be if you would have had Democrats in control of Congress in 2002, it would have been even longer. And that indeed had the critical voices that were heard, we wouldn't be talking about the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We'd be talking about the 2002 invasion of Iraq. I don't think anyone doubts that that Bush would have gone in sooner, and maybe that would have been good. Maybe that would have been bad. I'm not making a judgment on that. I just I can tell you that the timing, I think, was affected by this. You know, how did the local media, how did the national media look? Well, it turns out we've got, you know, data on the 50 biggest media markets in the country in terms of pro, anti, and they were fairly balanced. They were actually tilted pro in October of 2002 as Congress was debating this. The administration was getting about 70% of the airtime with the pro arguments in local news.
And I just want to stop you for a second. When you say they tilted pro, that's how you define it, by the amount of airtime, or how do you do that?
So both the amount of airtime, but also we had both ourselves and individual coders sort of go in and mm-hmm. say, okay, what were the individual arguments being presented? You know, is it Iraq has WMDs, this is good for stability, terrorism, et cetera. And so we would go through and sort of, you know, there were 15 possible arguments for, 15 against, and which of these were being parroted, you know, by local media or by national media. And, you know, the evidence is really clear that, yes, there were a lot of skeptical views in the media, certainly before the war, but the pro-war, I wouldn't say the pro-war views, but the administration views, anyway, were the ones that were the loudest and the clearest in, again, the vast majority of the time. So there's sort of empirically, you know, it's the pre-war situation, Lance, is just wrong. Post-war, that's up for debate. I mean, you know, did the media turn on this war before the public and lead the public against this war? You know, that's open for debate. We can't, we don't have the information or the data to speak to that question in particular. But, you know, it's true. Some of these stories do get legs on them that that don't have a lot to say, that don't have much behind them. But, you know, think about past wars, you know, for every article that Lance can show me that people have been anti-Bush, you know, we can find similar things in the media for anti-Clinton, anti-Reagan, anti-Carter, right? You know, I guess the broader point we try to make in the book is none of this is particularly new. I mean, this is, you know, politics really doesn't stop at the water's edge.
Let's move on and take another call right now. Ralph is with us from Cambridge. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning. I was trying to pick up on the notion of what we would consider to be a victory or an end of this. And in my view, we have to look at the objectives that sent us in there initially, and it was really to control the supply of oil. Hussein would not abide with the OPEC rulings, and hence he flooded the market, sometimes withheld, and therefore controlled the price of oil. So victory is going to be could be announced as soon as the parliament agrees to the current energy plan on distribution, etc. But the distribution, unfortunately for them, is going to be largely in the hands of the Dutch and the British and the American oil companies. And when the government can control the length of the pipelines from being damaged, then we can say that the whole situation has been resolved. So, in my judgment, why that is going to be in the distant future, based on the number of disruptions of oil distribution that have been managed to make in the past.
Ralph, thanks for the call, and let's put it to our guest. It's hard to talk about the war in Iraq without talking about oil at some level. What role did you take a look at that in your book to find out what role oil does play?
We didn't necessarily. We didn't look at that question in particular. I mean, it's something I've done a lot of thinking about, and I'm very familiar with this argument about, mm-hmm. you know, oil was one of the main driving forces behind going in. I've never been particularly you can't talk about the region without talking about oil. So here's where oil played a difference, made it real difference. You know, our eyes were on Iraq in 1991 and with the first Gulf War, and currently because of the oil being in the region. I mean, this argument that, well, Saddam Hussein's a bad dictator, he's working on, you know, et cetera. There are a lot of bad dictators. They don't have the same oil, et cetera. So in other words, it gets our focus on the region. I'm not one that really favors this idea that we went to war for oil. I mean, I just actually don't believe that. Will it happen to be an important part of the battle? Will it happen to be an important part of what shakes out in Iraq? Absolutely, no question about it. Oil is clearly an issue for the sectarian groups that are fighting there and control over it, who gets the money from it. But to me, this was much more about, you know, the what we now know is the mistaken belief about WMDs. It was a belief about the region in general, about really mm-hmm. setting up Iraq as an example for the rest of the region and trying to make it a democracy. I mean, I really believe that a lot of individuals in the administration thought that was a real possibility. If oil came along, great. If not, you know, I don't think this was sort of front and center to their thinking, other than again, it gets all of us focused on the region. We care so much about the region and the fact there might be WMDs and the fact that you've got nasty dictators there, the fact that you've got one state invading another state in 1990 because of the oil. So it certainly draws our attention, and it's always there and present. But was it the real driving force behind this? I've never been a big fan of that particular idea.
I'm guessing, I don't know this, but I'm guessing you're also not a big fan of making predictions, but I'm going to ask you to make one anyway.
Sure.
As we look forward, there's already a lot of speculation about what the role the war is going to play in the elections in 08. Mm-hmm. You know, is it going to be extended to influence the presidential election? Is it, you know, all that sort of thing. Do you see those two events as being linked? Obviously, the presidential elections, the war will be a factor.
Yeah.
But is it going to end or be lengthened because of those elections, in other words?
There's a very good chance, in my opinion, that it won't end. So I think the scenario is this. If you get Democrats, especially in control of both Congress and the White House, you'll see the war wind down. I don't think you'll see it end quickly, but I think you'll see massive drawdowns. I don't think you'll see that before, because I don't think the Senate, I think the House is going to do its best to try to draw down. I don't think the Senate will allow that to happen, and I think Bush has sort of a veto proof, can veto that's, you know, he can't get, that the Senate can't reject. Post-election, if Republicans win, Democrats remain in control of the Senate, I still think you see the same thing. I think you see a beginning of the drawdown process. And of course, all this is thrown open to what really will happen in 08.
Mm-hmm. And now we've talked about your book, what you've been writing about for the past 4.5 years. What's next for you? Are you going to continue this book? Or are we going to see a second edition or something totally separate?
Again, part of what we want to look at is comparing the coverage sort of 02 versus 06 to see how that's changed or not, to look at the dynamics during the war process.
Mm-hmm.
But also I may just sort of get something entirely new. So probably looking at more of a political economy issues like free trade areas, something along those lines.
Well, lots to talk about. And, you know, one thing we haven't mentioned, I keep calling you the co-author or the author, depending on which piece of copy I'm reading, but there is a co-author out there. What's that person's
name? There's a co-author,
name?
William Howell, is at the Harris School at the University of Chicago.
All right, very good. And the book is going to be published soon?
This summer, hopefully July, August.
And who's publishing it?
Princeton University Press.
Princeton University Press. All right, John Peavyhouse, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great, thanks for having me.
It's been a good hour. John Peavyhouse has been our guest and an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we've been talking about the book that he has co-authored, While Dangers Gather, Presidents, Congress, and the Use of Force. And that'll be published by the Princeton University Press, hopefully later on this summer. So keep your eyes open for that. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can have your very own by calling the radio store. They've got a toll-free number for you. It's at 800-747-7444. You can also, if you'd like, log on to our website at wpr.org. And look under our archives section if you'd like to hear it again without having to have a CD of it. And that's at WPR.org. Cheryl Gasser produced this hour. Leo Duran provided on-air production. And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.